Good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. And excuse me here a moment while I find the script, which I never use. I am the minister here, Sandy Ingham, and I will tell you this while I search for the script that I'm looking for. We have different sorts of services every Sunday, so if this is one of your first times or you're visiting, we encourage you to come back because the services are different. Sometimes they're led by me, the minister. Often they're led by members of the congregation. Like this morning, Christina Clock will be leading the service and presenting something very interesting, I think. And sometimes they're led by people outside the congregation. Here is what I was not looking for. Oh dear. Well, I hope it's still here. I can come up with it. Ah. This is the script that I often don't use, but we had a new Unitarian Universalist orientation a week ago yesterday, and several of the newer people said this is one of the reasons they came and stayed and were hooked on us. So here it is. Good morning. I already did that. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and open-minded congregation. Notice the words aspires to be. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender, or family structure. We welcome you, no matter what your age or your abilities or inabilities. Later in the service, we will invite visitors and guests to introduce themselves if they wish to do so, so that we might get to know you better. And I've already told you the last part of it about the wide variety of programs we present on Sunday mornings. Before I do the announcements, I would just add something for you to think about, that at the Free Congregation in Sauk County, they do something very similar to what I just read about whom they welcome, but they also add those of whatever political persuasion. I think we should think about that. Okay, first of all, the 8th grade through 12th grade class is still holding that vote to assess this congregation's beliefs about God. If you haven't already voted, please pick up the half sheet of paper on the table just outside this room, and you will find many possible options. So please choose one, up to three actually, which the one, three which most closely match your beliefs. Mark that, put it in the ballot box. Write any additional thoughts you have on the comment sheet by the voting station. And thank you from their Rachel Long, one of their teachers, and Barb Park, and from the students. Please, we're trusting you to not vote twice. This morning we are we've made a couple of changes in the order of service. One we didn't know we were making when we asked Mary to do the prelude. But we also are not going to do joys and concerns this morning. We anticipate having a fair amount of discussion after Christina speaks. But remember, this is also a potluck Sunday, which not potluck program-wise, potluck food at the end, and a very important fall annual parish meeting. So you certainly may talk about your joys and concerns while you're standing in line waiting for food or while you're eating. Please note that this is Transgender Awareness Week. I hope that you all take a couple of moments and search the web or go to the library or ask me or anyone else for books about this subject. This is a really positive step forward. It's a tiny step forward, but just having something that we're calling Transgender Awareness Week is pretty amazing.
Our opening words today are by Albert Schweitzer, who was a Unitarian Universalist. And I'm going to take the liberty of changing some of his wording to make it a little bit more modern. The great fault of all ethics hitherto has been that they believe themselves to have to deal only with the relations of Homo sapiens. In reality, however, the question is, what is our attitude to the world and all life that comes within our reach? Until we extend the circle of our compassion to all living things, we will not ourselves find peace. Our chalice lighting today will be a unison reading of our UU principles. And there should be a little slip of paper with your program to use as a guide. And I would welcome our members to go ahead and join their voices with ours, or read silently as you so wish. We, the members of Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society, covenant to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, acceptance of one another, and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, the right of conscience, and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and in society at large. The goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all, and respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. Okay, I would really like to speak to you today about something that is brewing in Unitarian Universalism called the First Principle Project. Actually, it's not a new project, so I'll get into that a little bit more. So as Unitarian Universalists, we share a living tradition of wisdom and spirituality drawn from many sources. And we call it a living tradition because we wrote our principles, and we can modify our principles if we so desire. These principles are not dogma or doctrine, but rather a guide for all who choose to participate in Unitarian Universalism. And our first principle, as we read today during our chalice reading, is the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Well, what about the inherent worth and dignity of all beings? I'm going to go through, hopefully, a fairly convincing argument. You shall tell me. And some of the points that I'm going to make are, humans are different from all other animals, right? What is a person? And I'm going to refer back to a presentation that was given to us in January. And unfortunately, Matt Tedesco, who gave that presentation, couldn't be here today, but I'm going to recap some of the things that he shared with us about the definition of the word person. Diversity and a living planet, we're going to talk about that briefly. And then we're going to talk about the process to update the first principle and some discussion points. So what makes humans unique? There are many things that we could talk about because, of course, all species do have special characteristics. And an individual of any species is a unique being. But let's reflect on whether humans are really much different from other animals. And to do this assessment, I'm going to look at two criteria, one of which was already introduced to us, tool use, and then we're going to look at language. So until 1960, the general agreement among scientists was that humans are unique in their use of tools. Spurred on by excitement in the paleoarchaeological profession with findings of early hominins and their stone tools, this was really a common thought. Tool use was considered the defining characteristic that separated us from other animals, hence the sobriquet, man the tool maker. I don't know if you remember that phrase from back in the 50s and 60s. Tools require a sophisticated level of cognition to make and to utilize, and this is an example, I thought an interesting example of a Stone Age axe made, of course, by humans. It's around 50,000 years old, and I gotta say, I'd like to think that I could make a tool like that if I had to. I hope I'm never put to the test. Okay, no. So we already had a wonderful children's story that talked about Jane Goodall. So Jane Goodall's most important discovery, really, was the use of tools in Gombe National Forest. It was actually October 1960. And there's a chimp that was using a stick to, just like our children's story said, fish out termites and ants and other things. Louis Leakey was her mentor, and he said, Now we must redefine tool, redefine man, or accept chimpanzees as human. So, of course, what we did was, go ahead, Bill, define a tool. So there are many definitions of tools, but two of the most commonly used ones in science, because they're simple and elegant, is a tool is an object that can be that has been modified to fit a particular purpose, or a tool is an object carried or maintained for future use. Go ahead, Bill. You can go ahead and click. So I'm going to go through some examples of what we have found since that seminal discovery in 1960. Crows and their relatives have exceptional brains. Corvids are what they're called, crows, ravens, and the like. They're exceptionally adept at crafting twigs, leaves, and even their own feathers into tools. Researchers have even discovered that crows have extraordinary problem-solving capabilities, and they've seen them figure out how to drop stones in pitchers to raise the water level so they can get the treat inside, just like in Aesop's fable. Go ahead, Bill. Elephants have been observed intentionally dropping logs or rocks on electric fences to short them out. They plug up water holes with balls of chewed bark to keep other animals from drinking there. And Asian elephants in the wild have been known to systematically modify branches to swat at flies that they can't reach with their tail and their trunk. Go ahead, Bill. Sea otters, other than being remarkably cute, are the largest member of the weasel family. And they, as I think you've all heard, they use stones to pound open abalone shells and other shelled creatures to get the meat inside. But they also do something rather astounding. This otter is wrapping himself in kelp. And they wrap themselves in kelp so they don't drift away while they're sleeping. And another adorable, it's not an example of tool use, but I just have to share this. An adorable thing they do is they like to sleep in groups. And those are called rafts, the raft of sea otters. And they all hold hands. Go ahead, Bill. Now, the interesting thing about tool use by an octopus is that this is an invertebrate. And all the other things, I've talked about birds and mammals, but octopuses are an invertebrate. They belong to a whole other branch of the animal kingdom. An octopus, you can see him here, uses a coconut shell as portable armor. The veined octopus apparently has been observed stacking these coconut shells. These coconut shells have been cracked in half by humans and discarded, but they stack them like bowls. And this octopus stacked up a whole stack of them, sat on top of it, made his legs stiff like tripods, and walked along the ocean floor, scooting them along and caching them away, so he could go there and use them as body armor later. Now, that shows future intent of future use as a tool. You could just go wild with that one, and that's an invertebrate. And one more, no? So this one is really, I love this one. So macaques, obviously we know monkeys are smart, but this is just an amusing example. Macaques living near a Buddha shrine in Thailand are known to pull out the hair off the heads of visiting tourists and use them as teeth floss. So go ahead, Bill. So tools do not make us unique. I think we all knew that. Language. I wish I had more time to talk about language, but I had to keep it brief. For decades, scientists have been debating if non-human animals have language. I'm going to call this guy Dr. S because I would mess up his name. So Dr. S at Northern Arizona University studies prairie dogs and has provided compelling data that these wonderful rodents, as well as many other animals, do have language, and they have a lot to say to one another. In addition to the charming and highly verbal prairie dogs, other animals including bees, squid, birds, bats, monkeys, and whales, among others, possess languages of varying complexity. Prairie dogs, for example, have different alarm calls for various predators who try to eat them. This researcher found they can describe the color of clothes, and they can communicate about the body style, tall, thin, short, of a human being. And he did this very scientifically and recorded all their chattering noises and analyzed them very closely and found that they were making up these communications. They're very, very social creatures and communicate at a very high level. Now, Dr. S. correctly notes that it is essential to study wild animals because, quote, laboratory environments aren't necessarily conducive to animals expressing their full range of behaviors. When you sit in a cage all day and then are taken out for an hour or two by someone in a white lab coat, you might not choose to display any behavior rather than fear. In a nutshell, Dr. S. uses linguist Charles Hockett's 13 features of language and shows how non-humans share them with us. And here's another quote from the professor. I show that we already have the evidence to conclude that a number of animal species have semantic signals and that these signals are arranged according to rules of syntax and with different contexts. Dr. S. also recognizes that the idea that animals have language is frightening to some people, but also empowering to those animals. When people find out that an animal species has a language, they often look at that species in a more compassionate way. He's right, because when we recognize the highly evolved cognitive and emotional capabilities of other animals, it requires us to treat them with more kindness, more respect, and more dignity. It's bad biology to rob animals of their cognitive and emotional capabilities. Okay, go ahead. I wanted to share this slide. I thought it was interesting, but our brains are completely different, right? No, they're not. When you look at the brain stem coming up, that's called the reptilian brain, and we share that same structure with reptiles, mammals, many species share that. And then the red up into the teal is called the mammalian brain. The mammalian brain is shared across all mammals, hence its name, and it's the seat of our emotional life. Love is found here, all our emotions, attachments to others, and family and social ties. And I think you can see from the pictures of the parent and the infants how closely, just from observing some of our fellow mammals, how closely we act. We act very similarly with our infants. Go ahead, Bill. So we are all related. The work of biologists and ethologists continue to blur the distinction between humans and the rest of the animal kingdom. Our differences are a matter of degree, not of kind. So I mentioned Matt Tedesco. He is an associate professor of philosophy at Beloit College and a member of our congregation. He gave a presentation way back in January on advances in our thinking of the word person. So human is a biological species membership. A person designates membership in a morally privileged group, and this is through the work of philosophers and legal systems. There are five central traits to personhood that Matt shared with us: consciousness, reasoning, self-motivated activity, communication, and self-concepts. And providing legal rights to non-human beings is a growing reality in the world, not growing as fast as I personally would like to see it, but it is a growing reality as we learn more about our planet. Go ahead, Bill. So here are some legal actions that have happened around the globe, unfortunately none of them in the United States. They're not in any order. 2007, the Balearic Islands passed the world's first legislation granting legal rights to all great apes. 1992, Switzerland amended its constitution to recognize animals as beings and not things. That is excellent. I love that one. Way back in 99, New Zealand granted rights to a limited number of great ape species, banning their use in research, testing, or teaching. 2002, Germany granted some rights to animals, an amendment to its constitution. And in 2013, just a year and a half ago or so, India banned the importation or capture of cetaceans, which are whales and dolphins, for entertainment, exhibition, or interactive purposes. They are highly intelligent and sensitive, and it's morally unacceptable to keep them in captivity. And I love this next one, a very interesting case in New Zealand just a couple years ago, an agreement to grant legal personhood to the, and I'm not going to pronounce this right, does anyone know, Rangawanui River, was signed between New Zealand government and the Maori of New Zealand. They each appointed a guardian to protect that ecosystem. And this is a picture of that river, it's gorgeous. Now some people might say, well, that's just too much, granting personhood to a river. Well, I think it makes a whole heck of a lot more sense than granting personhood to corporations. You all agree? Yes. 5,000 species of mammals, 10,000 species of birds, 16,000 species of mushrooms, 30,000 species of fish, 40,000 species of crustaceans. Now, pause there for a minute, Bill. Notice where mammals are on the diversity scale. There are not a lot of mammals on this planet. One of those seems to have overrun the planet, but really we're not a very diverse set of the branch of life. And click once, 950,000 species of insects. That is pretty incredible. Click once, Bill. So this is JBS Haldane, and I know a lot of you know the story, but in perhaps an apocryphal story, JBS Haldane, who was a British genius, really, in math, philosophy, and biology, was giving a talk at a church. It was about biology. After the talk, he found himself surrounded by amateur theologians. They wanted to know, what have you discovered about our Creator from your work in biology? To which JBS Haldane replied, go ahead, Bill, click, God has an inordinate fondness for bees. He looks like a jokester, doesn't he? So, Aldo Leopold is generally credited with describing the mechanism of a trophic cascade. A trophic cascade is a way of describing the interrelationship of an ecosystem, a way of looking at and studying ecological communities and the delicate balances that impact our planet. And this video that I had, it was a YouTube video, and I swear it worked, right before, is a video about the reintroduction of wolves to Yellowstone Park. Wolves were reintroduced in, Ingrid, do you know when, 1995? I think it was 85. And the effect that it had to the entire ecosystem was amazing. Wolves, of course, preyed upon the deer and caribou there. And wolves prey upon the very young and the very old. Because people say, well, we could control the deer populations, but hunters shoot animals at the prime of their life. So we do not hunt animals the same way nature interacts with predation. We just don't. So by taking the very young and the very old, they kept the deer population in an appropriate balance. By keeping the deer population in an appropriate balance, different vegetations that the deer typically ate started to become more abundant. So there was an increase in all sorts of different kinds of wildlife, including bears who ate berries, and foxes who relied on mice that ate kind of the smaller vegetation and insects that lived in the vegetation. And then the amazing thing that they found is it changed the behavior of the river that flows through Yellowstone. Because the behavior of the deer was such that they didn't get down by the river as much anymore.
because that was a place that the wolves came. So they went higher up in the altitudes, and all this ecosystem grew up around the river. The river became more meandering. It's incredible. You really have to see the video. I'll get it out to you. It's very, very moving. And I have to put a plug in, since we can't play the video, I'm just going to keep on talking. I have to put a plug in. There has been, for years now, an effort to reintroduce wolves to Wisconsin. It was very, very successful. It was so successful that the powers that be, in their wisdom, decided to take the gray wolf off the endangered list. Within 70 hours of taking those wolves off the endangered list, we approved, via our government, in an emergency vote to hunt wolves.
Right.
And the wolves are being hunted to extinction. So this is a really, really important topic in Wisconsin. I would urge you all to get educated and involved. I've got a petition up on my Facebook page that you can sign if you so desire. If you're not my Facebook friend, I'll friend you all. So anyway, I just wanted to put that plug in. Okay, so the first principle project, because I want to stop talking and I want to get some conversation going here, but I want to give you some background here. This is like the nitty gritty. It started in August 2013, about a year and a half ago, by some like-minded UUs. The facilitator of this initiative is Dr. Laura Kim Joyner. She's a UU minister and a veterinarian. She lives in Florida. The goal is to expand the language of our first principle to be more broadly inclusive of past persons. Our principles have not been updated since 1985. It was interesting because I read, in researching this, I read an article in UU World Magazine that was written in 2000 saying people are being restless about our principles and we knew this was going to happen. That was 15 years ago, so. Yeah, it's been a long, long time. You know, I was thinking, what happened in 1985? Let's see. Big hair, mullets, you know, it's a long time ago. So what is the process to change our principles, because that is not an easy thing to do. First of all, 15 congregations need to vote on a resolution to add this topic to the agenda at the next GA. Once on the agenda, the UU Board of Trustees works with those voting congregations and the sponsors of the First Principle Project to word the bylaw change and prepare for a vote. The first vote at GA is not to pass the wording. It's simply to determine by simple majority if this topic is worthy of study, reflection, and discussion. And a yes vote would appoint a study commission lasting no longer than 2 years. The study commission would then study and come back with a refined wording for a resolution. Then there is a second vote, and during that second vote, the wording can be changed from the floor. So there, and that must pass by two-thirds majority. So it is quite a stringent process. So far, three congregations have signed the resolution. And I don't have the exact wording of the resolution, but I'm going to get that to everyone too. Now those three congregations, guess what they're most aligned with? Buddhist philosophies. So I gotta say, if Prairie can't be the fourth congregation, nobody can. I mean, we're so aligned with this. I feel like we should seriously consider taking this to a vote. Now the deadline for GA in 2015, or the deadline for GA is always the February 1st for agenda items. So I think the people who are involved in the First Principle Project know this is not gonna go to GA in 2015. There's just not enough congregations. So we're looking at 2016 if we can kind of muster the. Okay. So I interviewed Dr. Laura Kim Joyner. I talked to her last Saturday to say, what has the feedback been so far that you've gotten on this resolution? She said there's been a couple of themes. The first theme is, you know, we're mostly humanists and we have to focus on humans. There are too many important issues requiring our attention. This is just something that the animal people want. I mean, is that kind of attitude that we're facing? Expanding the wording of the first principle would dilute our call to social action, that kind of a feeling. So my response to that is Unitarian Universalism has a proud tradition of a progressive history of expanding the circle of inclusion. Voting rights for women, education for all, ending slavery, marriage equality, LGBT rights, so much more. This seems right up the Unitarians' alley, and I would like to make the statement that inclusion strengthens. It doesn't weaken causes of human rights. The other one is a kind of a funny one. Does this mean I have to be vegan? Do I have to support PETA? No, you don't. Now, I'm sure there are a lot of people in our congregations who do. That is perfectly fine, but doesn't mean you have to do anything. That's not the nature of our principles. And then the last one is, I love this one. I won't vote for this if plants are beings, or I won't vote for this if plants aren't beings. Or I don't like the word being. Well, you know, I think that's why there'd be a study commission. I mean, obviously, you're not voting on the wording. It's voting to say this is worthy of study. And then my final slide was just a quote from Black Elk. All things are our relatives, and what we do to everything we do to ourselves, all is really one. And with that, I would like to get a little discussion going. I'm going to figure out some way to get a better sense from all of you on whether you want to go forward with potentially a vote at our spring parish meeting on this resolution. So please think. I'll be in touch somehow. We'll see how. But thank you so much for your comments and for your attention this morning. I just want to personally thank everyone for coming today. It was fantastic to look at the big group who came here. Our closing words are from Chief Seattle, very similar to what Black Elk had to say. What is man without the beasts? If the beasts were gone, man would die from a great loneliness of spirit. For whatever happens to the beasts soon happens to man. All things are connected. Thank you very much. Please greet your neighbor and have some coffee.
Stay for the meeting.
And the meeting and the potluck and